A masterclass in diplomacy today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. As U.S. Secretary of State, Madeleine Albright knew how to get to the point.
When I traveled somewhere, it would all begin very nicely, and then I would say, I have come a long way, so I must be frank.
Albright and former State Department envoy Wendy Sherman join me today for some frank talk about diplomacy, and Sherman's got a message for current Secretary of State Rex Tillerson.
For the life of me, Mr. Secretary, I don't understand why you believe that destroying the Department of State helps you do your job.
Plus, we remember author Ursula K. Le Guin and her love of inventing new worlds and languages.
That's like kids who draw maps of imaginary islands, you know. Well, some of them go on doing it till we're 80.
That's all coming up today on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. Well, here's a thought for the top of the show today.
Many of the best diplomats are women, though there are men that can do it.
That's Madeleine Albright, former Secretary of State under Bill Clinton. We're going to be hearing from her and another top American diplomat, Wendy Sherman. Sherman was a negotiator for Bill Clinton on North Korea and also a negotiator for Barack Obama on the Iran nuclear deal. Sherman and Albright told us how their friendship goes back decades to when Geraldine Ferraro was nominated as the first woman vice president in U.S. history, an important moment that serves as rich symbolism for their own careers. We wanted to ask them about diplomacy, which has often been described as the art of carrots and sticks. But this is a different world, and when a lot of diplomacy happens in 280 characters, carrots and sticks sounds kind of old school. More on that in a minute. But first, I asked Secretary Albright and Ambassador Sherman how they approach diplomacy.
I do think women are much better at having peripheral vision and also multitasking and having the capability of telling it like it is and at the same time use a little charm. I used to, when I traveled somewhere, it would all begin very nicely. And then I would say, I have come a long way, so I must be frank. And I think that you are not doing your job if you do not represent your country's interests. And so I do think that women are particularly good at diplomacy. And the truth is that Ambassador Sherman was smart and tough in our talks with Iran. That was the perfect kind of mix of being smart and being able to relate to people and get a good result.
So what you both do is diplomacy. And diplomacy is this thing that we can't see, and yet it keeps us safe and keeps the world from exploding. Break it down for us and share something anecdotal, so we can appreciate what it is, because I kind of feel like diplomacy is like air. We don't think about it, but it's there. What is the example you use for people who don't get what you do?
The president these days, and he will speak to this in Davos, I'm sure, about America first. Well, of course, every country puts its own interests first, but the interests that we have don't just stay inside of our country, whether it is concerns about cyber or terrorism or climate or the movement of people. All of these things cross borders. They don't stay within the borders of any one country. So you have to build alliances. You have to understand other people's interests.
I think diplomacy is a way that countries talk to each other. It is the bread and butter of relationships between countries. But it does, in fact, require the human touch. And what it is obviously defending the national interests of your own country. That's what you're doing. But in doing it, what you have to do if you're a good diplomat is to put yourself into the other person's shoes and see what it is they need out of a particular discussion. There are some parts that are very personal and some where you are very good friends with that particular diplomat, but you still have to argue. Or you actually don't like the person, but you have to be nice to them in order to get the business done. So it is I see it as very much of a relationship issue.
So putting yourselves in the other person's shoes, I mean, that is kind of a basic element of empathy. And just to get at that, let's listen to a moment in a recent PRI podcast, Things That Go Boom. This is Lacey Healy, host of the podcast, speaking with Alexandra Bell, who's the senior policy director of the Center for Arms Control and Nonproliferation. I want to hear this and then get your reaction.
This is not just a Trump administration thing. The State Department often has its budget cut while the Defense Department has its budget plussed up. And that is sort of a symptom of a larger problem, which is that diplomacy is often sort of seen as the sissy option, I think. And going even a little deeper, diplomacy is often seen as sort of the female option. My opinion is clear, but do you think that there is an innate bias sort of in our treatment of diplomacy, and that that's something that maybe is intricately tied to a bias around women in national security?
All right. So, Ambassador Sherman, a diplomacy, the female option. What do you think about that?
Well, look, if a female option is to be tough, to be smart, to make sure that your interests are met, that your objectives are met, then I'm all for the female option. And quite frankly, diplomacy is often most effective when backed up by a credible threat of force. And so, as Secretary Albright teaches in her class in Georgetown, you have to use all of the tools in the toolbox: diplomacy, military force, intelligence, cyber, sanctions, treasury capabilities, our economic power. All of these powers have to be brought together to achieve an objective. And diplomacy is about pulling all of those threads together to get to a smart, tough choice that meets our interests while leaving other countries with enough power to meet their own interests and support ours.
Ambassador Sherman, you mentioned Davos, and I got to say, with Trump going there, we're looking back again at the 2016 election, surprising people, taking many people off guard, the way that globalization kind of sparked this anger. And now Trump, the populist, is attending Davos, is beating heart of globalization and its wealth. What do you make of these two worlds coming together? Do you see them as two worlds?
Well, it's very interesting. I came here, we're doing this taping from Wellesley, and I came here from India, from the Raisina Dialogue, and obviously Prime Minister Modi was the first speaker at Davos. And he spoke about the importance of climate and addressing climate change, dealing with terrorism, and supporting globalization, because particularly in the developing world where a lot of growth is going to happen, where markets are going to open for American goods, globalization is very important. In the developed world, where we have really moved forward, we're a post-industrial economy, we are very concerned about what we're losing as jobs go in emerging markets. And we've got to figure out a way to move forward together so that those people who lose out in globalization, they're always going to be losers. Those who lose out because of technological advances, that we have their backs, that we support them. And I think many people in America obviously were concerned, though not a majority, since Secretary Clinton got more votes than President Trump. But nonetheless, in our system, there were a lot of people who felt they were left out and left behind, and no one had their backs. And so they were looking for someone strong to do that. I think one other point I'd make is that we are seeing incredible social change very fast. And for a lot of people, that leaves them unmoored and unanchored, and they're not sure what to do about it. And that adds to the level of anxiety.
This trauma didn't happen overnight, the trauma of globalization and what Trump's base is still kind of supports him on because of that. I mean, were Democrats just not seeing this? Did they miss it?
Yes, I do think that there has not yet been a proper adjustment to what is kind of an entirely new phase in national and international affairs, which is the role of technology. And we haven't even hit the high points yet with artificial intelligence coming in and a number of different elements in terms of what people have to take into consideration. I do think it is the job of every president to protect the people, the territory, and the way of life of a country. The point is, however, that I think the two of us would see that all three of those elements can only happen if we are operating within some kind of stable world. It does matter what is happening globally, what relationships we have with other countries. Not that everybody is wrong and taking advantage of an America that is weak. America is not weak. America is great. And really, we need to be a part in solving the global problems in the way that Prime Minister Modi talked about. You don't have to be a rocket scientist to understand that you can't deal with some of the issues like proliferation and climate change and poverty alone, no matter how strong we are. So I hope that President Trump actually listens to what some of the people at Davos are going to be saying to him.
This is no doubt a transformative moment for the U.S. and its standing in the world. It's also a transformative moment for women, especially the past year. And we've seen women marching in the millions, running for office, denouncing sexual predators. We also see the most male-dominated federal government in nearly a quarter century. Are women moving backward, do you think?
Well, look, I don't think change happens in a linear fashion, one step right after another. There are usually steps forward and then steps backwards. And to follow up on what I said earlier, there's a great deal of anxiety, particularly among men. If you're a 55-year-old, pardon me, white guy in the middle of our country and you lost your job and now you're told to take a course where you learn how to be a coder, and 2 years later you might earn half of what you did, and you've got to put two kids through college, and your health insurance is expensive. Women are in the workplace. Gays can get married, which I fully support strongly. You feel wondering, who am I and where do I fit into this society? And so, you know, you sort of assert yourself in ways that try to say I'm important and that the life that I once understood is still the life that I had. But life moves on, and women taking their full place in our society, bringing all their talents to bear, can only strengthen our economy, can only strengthen our country.
And Secretary Albright, what about bridging divides between women? Because there are many powerful conservative women. Can you tell us about a conversation you've had with a woman across the political divide and what you learned from that?
Well, let me just say, I think that people assume that all women agree with everything. Not all men agree with each other. And I think that generally what one has to do is to be respectful of people's views and then try to figure out what is motivating them. Yes, I have had discussions with conservative women, and I think that some of it is because they have felt that in their lives that they were not able to move ahead for some reason or another, and they are basically then projecting their own sense of despair or jealousy onto other women. And to go back to something that when Wendy and I met, as we said, during the Mondale Ferraro campaign, I traveled with Jerry Ferraro, and I'll never forget being somewhere in the Middle West and this woman coming up to me and saying, "How can Geraldine Ferraro talk to a Russian? I can't talk to a Russian." Well, nobody was asking this woman to go and have a conversation with the Russians. Mm. And there was this kind of sense of projecting her own sense that she couldn't do something onto another woman. And I feel very strongly that women do need to support each other. We need to be able to disagree with each other, but also understand that the country is better off when both men and women are able to be in leadership roles representing our country.
I know we're almost out of time, but a quick question for both of you. Let's say you're stuck in an elevator with Secretary of State Rex Tillerson. What do you use that time to talk to him about, Ambassador Sherman?
For me, I would say you have an exceedingly difficult and important job, and you need a team to help you do it. And for the life of me, Mr. Secretary, I don't understand why you believe that destroying the Department of State and having all of the senior foreign service leave helps you do your job. Diplomacy is led, of course, by the President of the United States, who is the elected person. But it takes many, many people to get it right and to get the job done.
Secretary Albright, you fill those shoes. What do you tell Rex
Tillerson? Well, I might be kind of even more direct than that and say, why don't you like your job? It's one of the best jobs in the world. There's nothing better than representing the United States. You can't do it alone, and you need to know actually what the State Department does. So I am very concerned about the fact that he has supported the cuts to the State Department budget, that he has not pushed harder in order to get the various positions filled. We have issues, for instance, with North Korea, South Korea. We don't have an ambassador there yet. And I think he has made his own job more difficult. But I do wish him well, because we do need a very strong Secretary of State dealing with an incredibly strong Secretary of Defense and a person in the White House that may or may not be interested in the same issues.
Secretary Madeleine Albright and Ambassador Wendy Sherman, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. This was a pleasure.
Great conversations that breathe what you get when you listen to the world. I'm Marco Werman with the world. When spring comes, the best part of it for me is starting up my roof garden again. The family gets fresh veggies, and yeah, it's container gardening, but it still connects me to the earth. Here's the thing. If the weather's bad and the plants fail, no biggie. There are supermarkets nearby. I know the kid will eat. Millions of families, though, around the world don't have that luxury. And for them, a small gardening plot can mean the difference between health and sickness, especially for young kids. But there's that extreme and unpredictable weather. From our Livable Planet desk, reporter Tipa Fernandez visited a farming area of Guatemala where the weather has changed a lot recently, and that's left families struggling with a new reality. Here's part two of our series on kids and climate change.
Far up top of a mountain in a remote area of Guatemala called Comitancillo, there lives a pig and some kids.
Fernando Pérez Mauricio.
Meet Oscar and Brian. They're 6 and 8, and they love the fact that a lady with a microphone has shown up. Their mum, like mums the world over, pushes them to sing for me. Cute, right? Yet behind their angelic grubbiness is a short lifetime of struggle. Their mother, Elvira Mauricio Diaz, dressed in her traditional Maya Mam skirt and top, is telling me about the difficulty she's faced in keeping her 6 children healthy, including her youngest, age 2, suckling at her breast. They're malnourished, which means a lot of trips down the mountain to find a doctor. There are no markets in Diaz's town, San Luis. The family's daily meals come straight from a small garden. It's called a milpa. It's very green, but it's also kind of in shambles. Diaz's little plots have been destroyed by a massive hailstorm, she tells me. And it wasn't the only weird weather recently. The past few months, it's begun raining heavily at 10 a.m., she says. The soil is too soft. It's not normal. And this worries her deeply because she hasn't been able to properly feed her children. It's a story I hear all over this part of Guatemala. Elio Ambrosio López teaches at a primary school in a nearby village. He says learning is a real challenge because many of his littlest students are malnourished.
Their minds are focused on the hunger they feel, and they can't concentrate on learning.
López grew up here, and he says he's now watching families struggle in ways that didn't used to happen.
Before, our grandparents had an exact day on which they would plant and cultivate the land. But if we follow the calendar they've always used, we won't grow anything anymore.
Today, there is so much sickness.
Midwife María Miranda Berdó says she's seen the impact on children in her village.
¿Por qué?
Why? I think it's because our weather is different. When it rains now, it's really heavy. But it wasn't like this before.
It's like the non-stop rain in the mountains of Comitancillo is making up for the previous years when suddenly the annual rainy season didn't come at all.
The last 4 years, not including the current year, have been extremely dry.
Edwin Castellanos is a professor in Guatemala City and the country's leading climate change expert. He says what the Maya Mam elders notice as unusual weather is related to the El Niño cycle. That's a natural phenomenon that causes swings between weather extremes. Scientists aren't exactly sure how much climate change is affecting the El Niño cycle, but they do know that in general, as the planet warms up, we're seeing more extreme weather events around the world. And that means more and more people, and especially children, will suffer the consequences. In the long term, Castellano says climate change could bring more dry weather to this country.
If you look at the models for climate change in the long range for Guatemala, they indicate that we are going to see a decrease in the rainfall gradually.
But he warns that too could have dire consequences unless communities find ways to adapt, which is what people in Comitancillo are doing. Hiking up a mountain in Comitancillo, a little child dashes out and hands me a peach.
Durazno.
And he proudly points to some trees where it grew.
Aquí.
Not long ago, that would have been next to impossible in these cold mountains. But Estuardo Aguillon of the Mayamam Research and Development Association says the region's warming up.
Because at this time of year, it would be between 10 and 15 degrees centigrade. Now, it gets up to 16 degrees. It might not seem like much, but even half a degree hotter has generated so many changes.
And those changes are not all bad, Aguillon says. Warmer weather means better conditions for growing fruit. So his job is to help people learn how to do it. The group is also helping introduce new crops like cauliflower and beets.
These new crops contribute to the family's vegetable gardens and to a more nutritious diet.
That's Aguillon's colleague, Erwin Orozco. He's also helping families here set up new water conservation systems.
And now with climate change, families need to find ways to capture and save rainwater and then reuse it to water their small plots of produce.
One of those new systems is here at this small home, where a group of mothers and daughters enjoy perhaps the best dishwashing view in the world onto green mountaintops and vast plains. The water from the sink goes to a holding tank for watering their milpa. Out back, Orozco takes a tarp off a full tank of rainwater. It's part of a simple yet intricate system of gutters and pipes that he says can help families keep their milpas growing when it doesn't rain. But adaptation strategies like these are all works in progress, and elders here say it hasn't been easy. They cost money and involve big changes to traditional ways. It's one thing to grow new crops, but then how to cook them? And will kids actually eat them? The family of a boy named Darwin has been giving some of this a try. Darwin is a strapping little toddler. He lost his mother right after he was born, so his grandmother is raising him. She tells me her name is Ofelia Miranda Miranda, and she says Darwin was healthy when he was born. But he quickly lost weight. He got very sick, and Miranda didn't know what to do. She got help from a community worker named Araceli Marroquin, who's also translating for me. First, she had to plant different crops, Miranda says. And then she was cooking them all wrong and losing all their nutrients. But she soon learned better techniques, as well as how to make the veggies tasty for Darwin. Miranda blows on the coals of a small open fire in her mud brick cooking hut, and flames begin to dance around the pot. Darwin looks on eagerly. The bowls come out and his grandmother dishes out a hearty soup. It's a peach atoll, a new twist on the traditional corn-based porridge using stewed peaches from Miranda's tree as a natural sweetener. As we eat, Miranda tells us how much her grandson likes to eat now, how much healthier he is. It's a small sign that here in the mountains of Guatemala, where so many kids have been battered by extreme weather and the changing climate, efforts to adapt to the changes might be helping. Miranda also wants to know when she might get help building a water catchment system. She's heard they work, and she'd like one. For the world, Tipa Fernandez, Comitancillo, Guatemala.
Tipa's reporting was supported by a grant from the International Women's Media Foundation. Tomorrow, our series on kids and climate change continues with a visit to the Galapagos Islands. The whole series is also online at PRI.org. I'm Marco Werman. Saudi Arabia is pledging to help starving people in Yemen, but the Saudis have also blockaded the country.
We welcome any plan that allows for more humanitarian access for Yemen, but it's a misconception that the Saudi-led coalition has fully lifted its blockade.
Humanitarian groups try to navigate the Yemen crisis. That's still ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. Donald Trump is on his way to Davos, Switzerland for the World Economic Forum. As a businessman, he was never invited to the annual gathering of the world's economic movers and shakers. And now, as president, he'll be bringing his populist America First message to the global elite. We'll see how that goes down. When the haves meet every year in Davos, it also draws attention to the have-nots. Oxfam recently released a report that found the world's richest 1% took in 82% of global wealth last year. So perhaps it's surprising that this year in Davos, you can experience a day in the life of one of those have-nots, a 45-minute simulation for participants who want to put themselves in the shoes of refugees.
They do fake gunshots. They make the women wear headscarves. There's a little bit of national stereotyping. A lot of the people here seem to find it very meaningful.
That's Miriam Elder, world editor at BuzzFeed. I asked her how the 1% of the 1% plug into a presentation like A Day in the Life of a Refugee.
The whole point of this conference, as it's sold, is that this isn't just a place for rich people to make themselves richer. The idea is to talk about the big forces and ideas shaping the world, and part of that is, I think, trying to make everybody feel better about making so much money. So they do things like talk about sustainable development and what refugees are going through. And then, as ever, there's a lot of talk about inequality.
Income inequality. What about Me Too and gender inequality? I hear you have a Davos party trick.
I don't trot it out all the time, but last night I was at a party and was speaking with somebody and happened to talk about women's rights and how it's represented in the media. And I'm not kidding. He walked away in 4 seconds. I've never lost somebody so quickly. You know, it is a subject of discussion here. There was a panel hosted today by the New York Times. They're trying, but part of the problem with Davos is that it is a microcosm of the world at large. And so women are just vastly outnumbered by men. Yeah. And, the racial diversity is even more of a problem.
Well, I saw one woman tweet from a luncheon there, and she said attendees were handing her dirty dishes and were waiting for her to pour them orange juice.
The fact of the matter is you're really surrounded by men and men in power, and when that kind of environment just brings out kind of the worst in everybody. So if a bunch of powerful men see a woman walking by, more likely than not, they're going to think that we're there to help, like we're there to check their coats or pour them coffee.
And does there seem to be some woke attitudes about race at Davos?
Not that I've seen so far. That's not to say it's not there, but not to what I'm plugged into.
What is the feeling of a populist like Donald Trump showing up in Davos?
Well, you know, I've been asking everybody that question, like, what do they expect to hear from him and what do they want to hear from him? And every single person I've spoken to has used the words either confused or intrigued. I mean, Trump's message is in direct odds with what the people here think their message is, which is an interconnected world leads to a better environment for people, for the growth of the economy, what have you. And Trump's message, of course, is America first.
Can Donald Trump actually connect with these people in Davos, Switzerland?
So last year, Davos was held in the middle of Trump's inauguration. And one of the stories that I reported from here then cited a closed-door meeting of bankers and other elite people where the overwhelming message was, make elites great again. So while publicly there might be some derision, I think the people at Davos in general will support somebody who's good for their bottom line. Some of the politicians who are here, depending on their country and their position, might have a difficult time with Trump. But I think in terms of the financial elite, as long as they're doing better off because of Trump's policies, then I don't see why they wouldn't accept him.
So what is the buzz at Davos this year? What's on everyone's mind?
Oh, my God. Every other thing is cryptocurrency or Bitcoin. So rich people are officially obsessed with Bitcoin and blockchain. Those are by far the biggest buzzwords this year.
Miriam, for our listeners who don't get it, and that includes me, can you explain blockchain in like 10 words or less?
No, I can't. I'm trying to learn, but I can't.
It's a mystery. Miriam Elder for BuzzFeed, thanks very much for your time.
Thank you.
All right. Explaining blockchain. It's kind of like diving off the 10-meter platform. We're here, so we might as well try to do it.
The best analogy, I think, is to consider this the Internet of Money.
That's Andreas Antonopoulos. He's the author of 2 books on virtual currencies.
It works with the collaboration of multiple participants, but no one is in control of the system itself. So we call that feature decentralization.
So how does the blockchain system work when someone wants to, say, buy Bitcoin? Antonopoulos says it's computers, thousands and thousands of them, that do the work.
So there's a set of rules, and these are really simple rules, like, do you actually have the money? Is the digital signature on the transaction correct so that we can verify that you are the rightful owner of this money? Every participant in the network will look at every transaction that's transmitted across the network and validate it against these rules. And only if they consider that transaction valid, will they send it or propagate it to the other computers connected to them? And so if you make a transaction on the network, it will ripple out across the network as each participant validates it according to their copy of the rules.
Now, you're talking about a certain amount of electricity to do this. I mean, does it require a lot of energy?
It does require energy. And what this energy does is it secures the system so that in order to cheat, you would have to commit more energy than all of the participants worldwide are committing to secure the system.
And why do you think all the wealthy people in Davos are so excited by blockchain right now?
You know, quite honestly, I think that's mostly hype. There's a lot of hype in this space, just like the early days of the internet, where people are talking about adding Web 2.0 to everything they do without really knowing what that is, and everybody around them applauds and throws money at them. And I think we're seeing a bit of the same in the whole cryptocurrency space.
Clearly, though, there are some places where it's not just about hype. Some of you may remember a few weeks back we covered the Estonia project, where in Estonia the government has digitized basically all aspects of citizen life, even voting, and they do that on blockchain. So, Andreas, is that the same type of blockchain system we've been talking about?
Not really. And I think that's one of the fundamental misunderstandings in this technology, which is that the very purpose of blockchain is to decentralize control, to spread the power among thousands of participants in such a way that no one can take control. And in order to do that, you have to have a system that is open, participatory, and public. Most of the private blockchains we see are highly centralized, meaning that one party is in control. In this case, that would be the IT department of the government of Estonia. And that kind of defeats the purpose.
In both cases, though, the data is secure, right? I mean, blockchain is described as tamper-proof.
Yes, I think that's a fundamental misunderstanding of the technology. So the security of an open public blockchain comes directly from both the commitment of energy and the fact that no one is in control or can take control over the system. So I have questions as to whether a centralized system where one party is in control can in fact be made secure or any more secure than a database.
So you're saying you have your doubts about how secure Estonia's system is?
Yes, as well as any government attempting to use this to promote or create a national digital currency. Essentially, what they're trying to do is use the benefits of a blockchain system without understanding where those benefits come from. And in the case of the Bitcoin blockchain, they come from the open, public, decentralized nature and the commitment of energy. If you take all of those things out and you create a closed, centralized system, you're just replicating databases.
So what potential blockchain applications are you excited about, Andreas?
To me, the bottom line is that payments and money, just that basic application, is so impactful. And doing that right and bringing into that kind of economy the billions of people who are excluded from the current financial system, I think that's big enough.
So you believe blockchain has the capacity to democratize economies?
Absolutely. It has huge possibility for serving the currently unbanked, not by banking them, but by giving them an alternative to banking.
Andreas Antonopoulos, he's authored two books on digital currencies. He's also the host of the podcast, Let's Talk Bitcoin. I think I got my head around this, the Internet of Money. I can wheel that out at a party and sound semi-intelligent about blockchain. What do you think?
Well, I hope so. I think it's okay to accept the fact that just like in the early days of the internet, this is a difficult thing to understand. It's going to take a while for people to get their heads around it. And that's okay.
Andreas, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you, Marco.
Saudi Arabia has announced a new program to bring aid into Yemen. That's the country it's been bombing for nearly 3 years. The world's Rich Hall was just in Saudi Arabia. So what is this plan, Rich? It sounds like it could be a breakthrough.
Broadly speaking, the plan is to give another $1.5 billion in new donations to the UN and other international aid organizations on the ground in Yemen. Basically, the money is to improve the humanitarian situation on the ground. That's what we were told in Riyadh. And much of that money will go towards port expansion. That's expanding the capacity of the ports where aid comes in, because Yemen imports 90% of its food and medicine. They're talking about creating an air bridge. That means they will deliver aid by plane to certain areas in Yemen. And the rest of the money will go into kind of just improving the facilitation of aid and fuel and things like that.
So we know that President Trump has been pressuring the Saudis to ease a blockade and let more aid into Yemen. Is there anything to suggest that that pressure led to what we're seeing right now?
There definitely does seem to be a realization on the part of Saudi Arabia that the perception of the war is very different inside the country than it is outside. The international community has been very critical of the way Saudi Arabia has conducted this conflict, the intense bombing campaign and the blockade of aid going into Yemen. Now, I spoke to someone from Save the Children who was recently in Yemen and asked them for their reaction on the aid announcement. And they said, although it's welcome news, there's still a lot of work to do.
As an agency that's working on the ground in Yemen, trying to deliver health programs, food supplies, vaccines, we welcome any plan that allows for more humanitarian access for Yemen and also more funding for the UN appeal. That's vital. But it's really important to remember that this is not going to solve the humanitarian crisis in Yemen. It's a misconception that the Saudi-led coalition has fully lifted its blockade on Hodeidah port, the main port in Yemen and the lifeline to the north.
That's Caroline Anning. She's with Save the Children. Now, Save the Children is one of the charities that is taking aid into Yemen. She was recently in the country and she saw firsthand the humanitarian crisis there. Now, she told me that the Saudis have eased some of the blockade in Yemen, but there still are restrictions on what can go in and out. And that is really putting the pressure on Yemenis.
As a result, there's crippling shortages of vital fuel across the country and massive price rises, which are hitting families who are already on the brink of starvation really hard. And it's also important to remember that it's only through a negotiated peace deal that puts an end to the fighting that we're seeing across the country. Just today, seven more people in a health clinic reportedly hit in an airstrike. Only a peace deal that puts an end to that and restores public services in Yemen will end the suffering of civilians that we see day in, day out.
So, Rich, you actually went to a press conference in Saudi Arabia convened by Saudi officials, and that's when this aid program was rolled out. Tell us what that press conference was like.
It was interesting to see the Saudi view of the conflict. Now, as far as they see it, they're fighting a legitimate war to restore the government of Yemen, the internationally recognized government of Yemen. They kind of seem surprised, or there's been a slow realization of how the conflict has been viewed in the international community. I managed to speak to the coalition's spokesman, Turki bin Salah El Malki, and I asked him this question.
Hi, Richard Hall, Public Radio International. The US has been quite critical on occasion of the civilian casualties, high civilian casualties in Yemen. I know the coalition has been working with the US on reducing them, but December was a particularly bad month for civilian casualties. Do you think there's still work to be done in that area?
Well, first of all, we don't agree in the coalition with the statement, say, the high civ cas is in Yemen.
So he's mentioning CIVCAS is there. That means civilian casualties. So the reason I mentioned last month, December, in my question to him was because December was a particularly bad month for civilian casualties. Now, the US has been working with training Saudi pilots to better target Houthis in Yemen and try to avoid civilian casualties. But there were a number of high civilian casualty incidents in December. But what Colonel Malki said is that he disagrees with some of the reports of civilian casualties coming from NGOs on the ground. He said they're unreliable.
Most of the report is coming from NGOs. It's not reliable because they are taking it from some of the NGOs on the ground, which belong to the Houthis.
Now, we would, of course, expect the spokesman for the coalition to say that. But it's not just NGOs on the ground that are saying it. It's the Saudis' own ally, the US, which has played a key part in this role. We must remember that it's funding this war. It's providing Saudi Arabia with weapons and funding for its military. So the US is very much involved in Yemen.
You know, between the comments from the NGOs and the Saudis, I guess I really just want to know, what does this opening up to civilians in Yemen tell us about where the war in Yemen is at, especially as far as Saudis targeting civilians there? I mean, how much does this change things?
It's hard to say. The aid agencies say this is a significant donation and it will alleviate suffering. But as you heard Caroline Anning from Save the Children say, the only way to stop the suffering in Yemen is to stop the war. And we haven't seen any major progress on negotiations between the Houthis and the Saudi-led coalition. And until that happens, the suffering in Yemen is going to continue.
The World's Rich Hall back at base in Beirut. Thanks very much, Rich.
Thanks, Marco.
Quite a few of us here in the newsroom were saddened to hear about the death of American writer Ursula K. Le Guin. In her 88 years, Le Guin did it all. Novels, short stories, poetry, essays. But she'll probably be best remembered for her works of science fiction and fantasy. She created entire worlds for readers, not to mention whole new languages. In a moment, the world's Patrick Cox, co-host of our World in Words podcast, with more about that. But first, a writer inspired by Le Guin, Saba Tahir, author of the young adult fantasy novels An Ember in the Ashes and A Torch Against the Night. Saba, you've been on the show before to talk about your work, but we've not really spoken about your influences. Where does Ursula K. Le Guin fit in for you?
Ursula was one of the first fantasy authors I read, and I encountered her books in seventh grade when my English textbook had an illustrated version of The Wizard of Earthsea. And you know, we all had to read this book, and I kind of didn't really get into it at first until I started paying attention to the illustrations, and what struck me was that the main character, Jed, had dark skin in all these illustrations, and I had actually never seen that in a fantasy before, so all of a sudden I was much more interested in this book, because even though Jed was a boy, I was seeing myself for the first time.
So that had never kind of happened to you when reading fiction?
Not reading fantasy. I had read books in which I saw, you know, maybe a Muslim girl, or I saw a Middle Eastern girl or an Asian girl, but I had not read any fantasy where I saw that. Most of my fantasy was very, very Eurocentric, very white.
And how did Le Guin's kind of recognition of the other eventually work its way into your own writing?
You know, everything she did seemed to be about balance. Like, she knew that there was some little brown kid out in the desert reading this book, and so she was going to be careful, and she wasn't going to mess it up by making this character of color flat or one-dimensional. She was going to make him good and evil. She was going to make him complicated, and she was going to make him like me. And that ended up having an impact on my own work, because that's, of course, what I seek to do, is try to make my characters multidimensional, try to show all their sides and all their facets.
So, Saba, for people who have not read Ursula K. Le Guin, can you point us to one of her books which would be like a good one as an introduction, or just something that may capture the moment we're living in now?
I really think Left Hand of Darkness is my favorite book by her. It's a very thoughtful book, and it deals a lot with these ideas of right and wrong that we may think we have, but when we consider them more deeply, we realize that this is just, you know, maybe how we're raised or the world we're in, as opposed to us maybe looking at things with a little bit more distance and a little bit more clarity.
Briefly, what is the plot and why do you like it?
So The Left Hand of Darkness is about this world that's essentially a genderless world, in which for like a few weeks each year, the people who live on the planet almost pick a gender and then they mate. And as a result, this world is supposed to have no war. And the world building is incredible because you're really immersed in this place. Like, you kind of look up and forget where you are, which is, of course, what the best fantasy books do, right?
The Left Hand of Darkness, the Ursula K. Le Guin recommendation from fantasy writer Saba Tahir. Saba, thanks very much for being with us today.
Thank you for having me.
Another big Ursula K. Le Guin fan is the world's Patrick Cox. Patrick is, of course, one half of our podcast on language, the world in words. So how are you remembering Le Guin, Patrick?
Well, I've been reading her novels and stories ever since I was a teenager. But I must say, I do have a soft spot for something that she did time and again, which was to invent languages.
And as I understand it, these are languages that people on certain planets or certain societies speak?
That's right, yeah. And I think that she did it to the greatest effect in her novel, The Dispossessed. There are two languages in that book, one each spoken on twin planets. One of the languages, it's kind of a natural language like English or Spanish or Mandarin. It evolves over time and reflects the values of the people who speak it. And those values include things like, you know, war, class difference, jealousy. So, you know, it's kind of like us.
Like Earth.
Uh-huh. The other language, which is called Pravik, it's not natural at all. It's a language that is entirely constructed by the leaders of that planet. And it doesn't so much reflect the values of the people who speak it. It seeks to shape them.
Okay, got it.
So a few years ago, I got the chance to ask Le Guin about this. And she told me this language, Pravik, it was the brainchild of these fictional utopian anarchists who live on that planet.
They want to remove from the language anything that implies ownership, private possession. And so you don't have possessive pronouns.
Wow. I mean, one of the first words I learned as a kid was mine. How do they get around that?
Yeah, they have to drill it out of the children. You know, the children's instinct, just like yours, is to say mine, my mother, my blanket. And instead, they're trained to say the mother or the blanket I use. The idea being that over time, they'll come to have a different understanding of these things. And also, people's names aren't owned, but they're designated randomly by a computer. So everyone gets two syllables, a couple of vowels, a couple of consonants. And then when they die, the name sort of goes back into the pool.
And the next person born gets it, so that a name is not given and possessed the way it is here. It's again, an anarchist attempt to sort of have things in common.
So in the novel, how does this linguistic experiment all work out?
Well, it does work. Not completely, though. The characters, they form attachments to one another. They are human, and they address each other using nicknames and diminutives, which is not quite in the spirit of how the language was intended.
Yeah, can you imagine this in real life? Like, how would that work in real life?
Yeah, right. I mean, most linguists would say that such a rigid language, supposedly forcing values on its speakers, is totally doomed to failure. We humans, we just don't allow ourselves to be imprisoned by language, over time at least. And Le Guin, she was well aware of the orthodox linguistic theory. Maybe she was just poking the orthodoxy just a little bit, as she liked to do. And I asked her why she felt impelled to invent languages in the fiction that she wrote, just as Tolkien and others have done before her. And her answer, for me, gets to something about her creativity.
There just are a bunch of us who love to invent languages as well as to learn them. A lot of kids do a certain amount of it, and some people carry it on all their lives. It's like kids who draw maps of imaginary islands, you know. Well, some of us go on doing it till we're 80.
Novelist Ursula K. Le Guin, who died Monday and kept it going until the age of 88. Patrick Cox from our World in Words podcast, thanks very much for this.
You're welcome, Marco.
And that's where we're going to leave it today. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH here in Boston, I'm Marco Werman, back with you all tomorrow.
PRI, Public Radio International.